Hello, it's Thursday, 11th of February. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, is going to shake up the NHS. It's another reorganisation. But is it the right time to do it? I'll be speaking to a former health minister. Some parents now think children being taught online in lockdown is advantageous. That goes, of course, against all the conventional thinking. Can a new app translate your cat's meows into human language? I'll be talking to the great cat lover and great friend of mine, Amanda Patel. And more than half of parents say they're talking about sex with their children far earlier than planned because of the internet. The Work and Pensions Minister, Will Quince, he's lost 6 stone in barely 10 months. He's going to tell me how he did it. The Work and Pensions Minister and Conservative MP, Will Quince. If you see him at the dispatch box in the House of Commons on Zoom these days, you'll be seeing quite a lot less of him because he's lost 5, maybe 6 stone after being inspired to diet during lockdown. He's had quite a few conversations with Boris Johnson too, who, of course, when he was hospitalised with COVID-19 in April 2020, was probably 17 and a half stone. Some people think 18 and a half stone. Will Quince, who's been the MP for Colchester in Essex since 2015, reached a maximum weight of 18 stone 7 pounds. He's now here to tell us how he lost all that weight. How did you do it?
Well, I'd love to say, thank you, Andrew, I'd love to say there was some great secret to it or magic pill or potion, but I'm afraid there isn't. And it was quite simply consuming less and exercising more, with actually most of the emphasis on that being on the consuming less.
What were you eating too much of before you decided to take the plunge?
Well, I think I was doing two things. I was eating too much of what I was eating, and I was eating the wrong things and bad things as well, and probably at the worst possible time too. So, and in part, I suppose that's one of the downsides of being an MP. And I know lots of other people that work in London or have to commute have exactly the same challenges, that you're in and out of meetings and you're grabbing something you shouldn't in between meetings just to keep you going, and then you get home of an evening. And you tend to eat something unhealthy later, and dare I say, even you crack open a bottle of wine and have a couple of glasses, and it just leads to quite an unhealthy lifestyle. So yeah, it was far too much of crisps, chocolate, carbohydrates, you name it, all the stuff you probably should only have in moderation.
And when you saw the Prime Minister, who's not an old man after all, he's only in his mid-50s, becoming very, very seriously ill in hospital with COVID, and Boris himself actually said his bulk, his weight was far too excessive. And we know that obesity is a major factor in the huge bill facing the NHS. It's probably a bigger killer now than cancer. And we think it is a factor in the number of COVID deaths in this country. Was that a sort of Paul on the road to Damascus moment for you? Or were there other triggers which made you think, I've got to do this?
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, I started off the beginning of last year where I knew I wanted to lose weight, and I was desperately trying. And most of that had done by that point, and the run up to the end of March, early April, had been just by reducing my calories and dieting. But the Prime Minister being so unwell, and I considered myself to be about the same size as the Prime Minister at that time. He's a little bit shorter than me, but I think we're probably about the same weight. And when he Well, I think we were all pretty shocked, weren't we? He nearly didn't make it, and right. And when he came out of hospital and said that he and the medical professionals believe that actually his weight had a lot to do with how badly COVID affected him, it scared me, and I think it scared a lot of others. And that's when I really picked up the exercise and doubled down on the dieting to try and shift some more weight.
Now, I know you took up running, and now you're very proud of the fact, because, of course, I wrote about this in our health pages this week, Minister. I know you're running every day. How many kilometres or miles are you running?
Well, very nearly. I did 10K every day in January,
which
I was very, very proud of. The snow has been a bit tricky over the past 4 days, but this morning I did venture out, and I must admit it was a bit like ice skating. And my wife said to me, I'm not sure that's a good idea, you going out this morning. And funnily enough, on Instagram this morning, I say funnily enough, it's not funny at all. I see Jeremy Hunt went out for a run, and it looks like he's either fractured or broken his arm as a result.
That's right, he's in a sling.
And I think he was out running as well. So I think it shows you've got to be very careful with exercise too, especially when it's slippery or icy underfoot. But yes, I'm big into the running at the moment. I can't wait to get back to the gym as well when they reopen. But actually, you know, the outdoors is our gym. Just take care of the knees and take it steady. But it's I'm enjoying the running.
And of course, being in lockdown, Minister, it means you've been working from home much more, which has enabled you to have a meal at a regular time. Because I know the Westminster life, sometimes you probably don't sit down to eat till 9:30 at night. It means you could sit down with your wife and your children. A, that's a nice thing to do as a family, but B, it's good to eat at a regular time. And also, of course, your wife could regulate how much you were eating.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and you do tend to therefore plan meals more, and you eat sort of normal portion sizes and tend to snack less too, because you're eating at regular meal times, and not eating late into the evening, which I think is if you can avoid it, definitely the right thing to do.
Now, if I can ask you, I know it's a bit embarrassing, but we need to know these things. What is your weight currently now? Because you've probably lost a bit more since we last spoke.
So I've managed to get below 13 stones. So I'm hovering around the sort of 12, 10, 12, 11 mark, which is probably the lowest I've been since school. So it's in a better place. I'm just into the healthy BMI category.
You must have been a bit of a lardy at school if you were about 13 stone at school.
I'm afraid I fear I was. Yeah, it's for me it's been a sort of lifelong battle. I've always struggled with my weight. Yeah. I say peaking at over 20 and a half stone about 10 years ago. I finally feel like I've cracked it, but having said that, I think it's going to be an ongoing battle for the rest of my life, and that's fine. I've just got to keep this better relationship with food going forward and keep up the exercise.
And is Mrs. Quince happy you're no longer snoring in bed?
Well, I think she's pleased about the snoring front, but I don't think she's all that keen on me having lost the weight. And she's now saying, you know, she doesn't want me to lose any more. She said far less cuddly and more bony, I think is the phrase I think she was using. But I feel far better with myself, and I'm certainly sleeping better, which is a good thing. And far less snoring, which I'm sure she does appreciate.
And just finally, there'll be people listening to this who think, blimey, he's lost 6 stone in less than a year or 9 months. What's your advice to people who've grappled like you with excessive weight for years and years and years, particularly now we're in lockdown when there is a temptation to go to the fridge and binge or snack? What is your advice to them?
Yeah, there is. And I have bad days still too. And, you know, days when I'll eat more than I should. And I think the key really is that it's a marathon, not a sprint. Don't worry if you have a bad day where you eat too much or you have that extra bit of birthday cake, as I have this week, as both my girls have had their birthdays. It's okay. You've just got to get back on the wagon as quickly as possible and just stick at it. And you're going to have days and weeks where you're going to lose lots of weight, and you're going to have other weeks where actually it's going to be more of a challenge and it doesn't feel like you're making much progress, but stick at it. And, you know, over the course of a year, or more, I think it's going to be an ongoing battle. You'll get there, but just, you know, set yourself lots of little goals, build in some treats as well. So, you know, rewards for yourself. Doesn't have to all be food, other things too. New clothes are a good incentive for that too. And just stick at it.
Good advice from Will Quince. He's looking a lot slimmer, a lot healthier, a lot more handsome. He's the MP for Colchester. He's also the Work and Pensions Minister, and he's 6 stone lighter. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to Andrew Pearce free and in full, along with all our other podcasts. And don't forget, we've got that fascinating series on Operation Midland and the complete screw-up the Metropolitan Police made into the lives of people like the late Leon Britton and the former Prime Minister Sir Edward Heath. There are also our video series. And don't forget, of course, remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, is to set out plans for a more integrated, more innovative and responsive NHS. In other words, it's another shake-up, another reorganisation. The White Paper, which sets out the proposed future legislation, will be published in the next few weeks, we understand. I'm joined now by Baroness Nicola Blackwood, who is a former Minister for Innovation and Department for Health, and she's also, of course, Chairwoman of Genomics England. I think I can call you Nicola.
That would be super.
Great. Nicola, the government obviously was disturbed, is probably one way of putting it, unhappy that the with what they regarded as the somewhat leaden response, in particular of Public Health England, when the pandemic first broke on British soil. We know Public Health England is being replaced by another organisation. This is the next stage. Is it the right time, though, to be talking about reorganising the NHS when we are still in the thick of the battle against COVID?
Well, so I think it's important to remember that these reforms have been in the works for a long time. There's been extensive consultation across the NHS about these reforms, and a lot of these proposals have actually been requested by the NHS. They are designed to empower patients to become sort of they've called it informed co-creators in their own health. I think if you are a patient in the health system at the moment, as I am, you deal with lots of NHSs. You deal with your GP, you deal with your hospital, you deal with the social care system, you deal with the mental health system. And the whole point of this is to integrate all of that, make it much more simple and straightforward by integrating budgets, by integrating data, by making it much more innovative and simple to use, a lot of which we have seen demonstrated during the response to the pandemic. But what they want to do is make sure that this is codified and works effectively after the pandemic, when we are going to face quite a lot of challenges due to the backlogs and the pressures which have built up during the response. And so that's why this is exactly the right time to do a lot of the reforms which have been prepared from before the pandemic. We want to make sure that they're ready to go after the pandemic.
Would you agree with the criticism that the NHS, in the first instance at least, was very slow to act? As I recall, Public Health England even had to apologise for the way it was counting the COVID casualties.
Well, Public Health England is one part of the NHS, and I think that we can say that a lot of the NHS has responded incredibly well. There have been an extraordinary global contribution, for example, from our scientists and researchers who work across the NHS. But, you know, no part of the NHS is going to say that they got everything right, part of which is because there was so much we didn't know and we didn't understand. And it's almost impossible to look back and say that we could have got it perfectly right. So I think everyone's going to hold up their hands and look and wish that they had done things differently at some point. You know, whatever. It's possible to look at every part of the system and say we could have done it better, I'm sure. But that's not really the point of this bill. This bill is to make sure that when we go forward, we can improve, we can innovate, and we can make sure that we get some of the things right that COVID has highlighted went right, and make sure that we embed them for the future. So, for example, one of the things which has been extraordinary has been the massive uptake of technology in order to deal with the need for social distancing and protecting those who are most at risk. And that would be something that is incredibly valuable to make sure that we can deal with some of the challenges of backlogs, making sure that we can sift through patients who are in waiting lists and make sure that those who are most high risk are dealt with quickly, those who are deteriorating are dealt with quickly. There are lots of technical solutions that will enable us to do that very effectively and efficiently, making sure that clinicians have much more time to deal with patients, doing the thing that they've been trained for, and spending much less time on bureaucracy and paperwork. At the moment, for every 1 hour that a clinician spends with the patient, they spend two hours on bureaucracy. We have the technical capability to address that. And at the moment, we're not making full use of it. And so part of the purpose of this bill is to make sure that we do make full use of it. There is also something which was very significant and came out during COVID, which was that it really highlighted the stark issues of health inequality and the way in which we need to embed prevention right across the system, and making sure that we have integrated care systems and that data flows and we can intervene much earlier in a patient's journey is one of the real purposes of the proposals that are being put forward.
Can I ask you too, one of the big issues that's been highlighted yet again by COVID care homes and the rest of it is the lack of an integrated approach to social care. Now, we've all lost count of how many prime ministers have said that they're going to get this issue sorted, whether it was Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron, Theresa May, including our own current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. This bill isn't going to do much to sort that mess out, is it?
There is no way that we can respond to the challenges which have arisen as part of the pandemic, but also the consequences, wider consequences of the pandemic, without addressing the challenges of social care. And it will be absolutely necessary that that is responded to as part of the comprehensive spending review, which is coming forward. And I know that that is completely understood in the Department of Health and Social Care and by the Secretary of State. And, you know, everyone across Parliament is expecting that that will come forward.
It's long overdue, isn't it?
Well, there's been quite a lot going on this year, but I know that this will have to be, it has to be dealt with. There is no way that we're in a sustainable position without having a long-term settlement for social care, and it's absolutely necessary.
If I could ask you just finally, it's been a story in quite a lot of the papers this week. You'll have probably read it yourself. At least one NHS trust down in Epsom has started charging hospital staff yet again to park their cars, nurses paying up to £500 a year. I remember when Jeremy Hunt was Health Secretary, he said he'd put a stop to it. Matt Hancock said he'd put a stop to it. I know this is an issue. It is a decision of the local NHS trust. But is there anything a government can do to ensure that nurses, who we all know and love and particularly admire what they've been doing, especially during the pandemic, shouldn't have to pay this sort of money?
They shouldn't have to pay this sort of money. And while it is a local decision, I think that one of the interesting things that came out during the pandemic was the power of leadership to shift local decisions. We saw just a letter from the chief medical officer through to all the local trusts massively accelerated the uptake of patients into the recovery trial, which found dexamethasone, which started saving lives immediately. And so I think part of the purpose of this bill is to create local powers and local decisions so that we can make sure that local populations can drive the solutions which they need for their local care. But at the same time, we also want to make sure that problems like that which arise can be amenable to leadership solutions, like, you know, stop playing around and charging your local nurses for things that they shouldn't be charged for.
Quite right, too. That is Baroness Nicola Blackwood, who's Chairwoman of Genomics England. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. You can leave us a horrible review as well if you want. We don't mind. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. The internet, where else, of course, is forcing parents to have the talk. It's all about the birds and the bees and sex to their children far earlier than they would ordinarily have wanted. More than half of the parents in the UK, 52%, have talked to their kids about sex by the time they're 10 years old, according to a study by cybersecurity firm AVG. It also found that 67% of parents agreed that the internet has accelerated those conversations with children. I'm joined now by Sue Atkins, who's a parenting author, and she's the author of Parenting Made Easier: How to Raise Happy Children. Sue, do you agree with this broadly, that the internet has meant that some parents have had to have that conversation with the kids sooner than they perhaps would have done?
Oh, absolutely, because of course kids are at home, homeschooled or home learning or e-learning or whatever you choose to call it. So they're being more and more exposed to all of this sort of thing. They're clicking on something by accident, of course, or they're seeing something that, you know, creates curiosity, and they're going to their parents. So yes, it has been kind of a concern, because I've been working with AVG about children being exposed to really inappropriate adult content, and of course that's the problem.
What is the answer here? Should parents be regulating more carefully what their children are looking at on their devices or the internet?
I think it's a combination, to be honest. I think it's a good idea to put in some antivirus, you know, software that's free, update it regularly, look at the security gateways, you know, make sure the passwords are changed and they're locked down carefully. And of course, not just on the phone or the laptop, but on across all the devices the kids are watching and looking at. You know, things like Netflix as well, you need to protect them, in case the gaming consoles as well, because they're out doing Fortnite, and that's got all that sense of community conversations as well. So you have to be mindful. But I think the important thing for me is about empowering children, talking and teaching them early about internet safety, helping them not be quite so trusting, because they do tend to be naive, no matter how old they are, even teenagers, about who they're talking to, what they're watching. And so I think even starting early in small ways, like saying, why do you think we need a password on here, even with young kids, starts them thinking a bit more critically about what they're doing and what they're seeing.
What is the answer to when you realise, perhaps with some horror, that your child is asking you questions about sex you realise, the parent realises, they've either been talking to a chum or they've genned up on the internet? Should the parent then dive in, maybe if the child is only 8, 9 or 10, and explain all, or do you just try to prevent them getting any more information from the net? What's the best approach?
Yeah, for my idea about the talk, as they say, I mean, you know, it's a lifelong conversation. You do a little bit at a time. So instead of sort of the big talk, that takes the pressure off you, that takes the pressure off the kids. And then if you have that kind of regular conversation, it sends the message to the children that, you know, it's an important enough topic to keep bringing it up. It's part of normal life. And then they can come to you for sort of reliable, truthful, confident and honest, you know, information. And the key thing for me is, don't sort of jump into conclusions about why they're asking. You know, you can say something like, well, tell me what you already know about that. Because then you're not launching in to give them too much information when they're not ready for it and they'll be horrified by it. So keep your answers short and simple, and then kind of say, well, what other questions do you have around that? And does that answer your question? And then they can come back to you, they'll hop and skip off, and they'll come back to you again maybe in another month or another year and ask you again, because they feel it's okay. You've not embarrassed them, you haven't shamed them, you know, and you have this natural conversation with them.
Is there, in your world, in your view, Sue, is there an ideal age by which that conversation should start to take place between parents and child? Or perhaps that conversation, in your view, should really be taking place in school with teachers?
Well, I'm a former deputy head and class teacher for over 20 years. And what schools do is that they give you the nuts and bolts, don't they? I remember that as a kid myself. They give you the biology, but they don't give you the loving, nurturing relationship around it, which I think is really, really important about respect, respecting yourself, respecting the other person, and putting it in a loving, nurturing environment, I think is very, very important. So between home and school, doing it together, then I think that's the best way. And for parents, it's about preempting it. Have a little think about what you might want to say so that you don't get embarrassed and flummoxed if they do ask you.
And is there a right age ever, or does it always depend on the particular child?
Well, again, it's their maturity, isn't it, of the child? And also, if they have additional needs or anything like that, you've got to be more mindful of what that is. Don't rush them. I'm a great believer in keeping childhood, you know, as innocent as long as it can be. But on the other hand, you must protect them and you must talk and teach them. We talk and teach them about crossing the road. We talk about keeping healthy and eating well. So again, this is a natural conversation that you can just do it in a, you know, just when you feel it's the right time for your child.
And I suppose one of the keys is, as well, Sue, the parent shouldn't show any embarrassment.
I think that's the key thing. I mean, we're a bit British about that, I suppose. I don't know what other countries are like. But, you know, don't be embarrassed about it, because then you set it up to be taboo, and then they get embarrassed and they think it's taboo as well, and then they won't ask you. Then they'll get the wrong end of the stick from their friend behind the log shed or wherever it may be, or they'll pick something up off EastEnders which you don't really want them to know. So talk with them. You talk about all sorts of things. So talk and teach them about this, you know, but plan ahead, perhaps, so that you don't get sort of shocked into it.
All right. Well, that's very good advice. That's the author, Sue Atkin. She is the author of Parenting Made Easier, How to Raise Happy Children. It's that point of the programme which we enjoy talking to Ruth Sundland, who is, of course, the Daily Mail's business editor. Now, Ruth, a big story today. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, doesn't speak out that often, but he's really squaring up for a fight with the European Union. What's going on?
So what this is all about, Andrew, is that Andrew Bailey, the Governor of the Bank of England, he is getting very annoyed over the situation around Brexit, where the EU is in effect telling the city that they've got to be a rule taker. They're holding the city to standards that they wouldn't agree to be held to themselves in any way, because at the moment, the deal that we signed over Brexit around Christmas time was only over physical goods. It was just over physical trade. It wasn't. It didn't take into account the city or financial services, which obviously is a huge part of our economy.
Yeah.
And the city is absolutely fantastic financial centre, held in worldwide renown. And frankly, I think a lot of people in the EU are very jealous about this and want to, you know, want to put a spanner in the works of it all. And what we had before was a situation where it was called passporting, and that's a bit of jargon. It just means that any British operation could sell financial services in other EU countries as if it were at home, you know, so it was complete equivalence.
Yeah.
They've refused to agree equivalence after Brexit, and they're now saying that they don't want to agree to that unless the UK, whenever in the future we might want to change our rules, the UK has to get effectively permission to do that from the Commission, which is clearly madness.
Not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. Going along with this, there was a story as well, which I suspect, you know, would be grist to the mill of the Remainers, the Ramoners, saying that share trading in London has been overtaken by share trading in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Now that sounds dreadful.
Yeah.
Except then when you think a large chunk of that share trading in Amsterdam is actually done through a platform that belongs to the London Stock Exchange. So it's not really having any great effect. All the proceeds are flowing back to London.
Right.
And also, share trading is only a tiny proportion of overall financial trade done on exchanges. So if you take account of derivatives, foreign exchange, interest rate derivatives,
yeah,
London is way, way, way out ahead of Amsterdam. So it's just more disinformation swirling around today about the city, propagated by Ramoners and propagated by the European Union. And I think this is something that we've got to sort out,
yes,
Andrew, because this isn't about the UK versus the EU. What this is about is we've got countries like China, like India, countries in the Middle East, who are really emerging as superpowers in the financial world. So it's about all of us in Europe and in the US and in other friendly jurisdictions, making sure that we keep financial markets going and that we keep standards high and we don't get overtaken by Beijing, for instance. You know, this is a much more important, bigger picture. And of course, they're in the EU. They don't think about that. All they think about is trying to bring London down.
And on that, Ruth, I'm fascinated by that. The when you talk about the share trading, it's a small part as opposed to derivatives and the rest of it. Is there, what sort of percentage would it be of the city's trade?
If only I could show you a graph that I have in front of me now, Andrew. So it's actually really tiny. I've got a chart here from New Financial and the Bank of International Settlements showing derivatives, foreign exchange and equities data from January 2020. And over-the-counter derivatives are by far the biggest in billions. So you've got a huge, you know, vertical line on that chart, and then followed by foreign exchange, which is another big chunk, interest rate derivatives, another one, and equities is tiny. It's you know, it's a millimetre on that graph.
Is it really? So it's probably in percentage terms. Is it in single figures?
I would have thought so.
Yeah, how interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah,
and
it's fascinating. They've got it all out of proportion.
Yeah, and of course, I saw that the story about the trading volumes in shares in Amsterdam at the British expense was on the front page of the Financial Times, which, of course, as we know, championed Remain.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And you know, Andrew, I was in favour of Remain.
Yeah.
And I voted Remain, and I'm not ashamed to say that, but now we've had the vote, we've got Brexit, it's time to move on. And I say that as a former Remainer, but I use the word former advisedly because, you know, I respect the vote that we had in the referendum, and it's time now to move on. We can't drag our country down continually ever after to try and prove that we were right to vote Remain. It makes no sense. I want my country to succeed.
Well said, Ruth, and I'm with you. That's Ruth Sunderland, who is our very fine business editor at the Daily Mail. So can a new app actually translate your cat's meows, murmurs, whatever they do, into human language. The app called MeowTalk is from the computer geek, engineer and devoted cat lover, Javier Sanchez. He's the brains behind Amazon Alexa. He thinks he can make it work. The cat lover, Amanda Patel, one of our favourite columnists, of course, on the Daily Mail, has tested it out on her beloved moggy, Ted Platel. She joins me now. Now, Amanda, I know Ted very well, and he talks to me. Did he talk to you with this app?
Andrew, it is quite curious. It has, at the moment, it's only got about 12 translations. And so I did what I was supposed to do. You follow him around with the app under his nose all day. And you know Ted, you can imagine how he takes that.
Yeah.
Not very pleased.
No.
But every time I recorded one of his sounds, I recorded him talking. Almost every time it came back, I am angry. Now, look, you know, Ted, he's the least angry cat in the whole world.
Exactly. He's sweet, he's mild-mannered. Not like my two great fat cats that kill everything that moves.
Your cats are killers. They're the Minnie and Rosie.
Yeah.
But Andrew, they talk a lot too.
They do.
But I've thought about it a lot when I was writing the piece, because I worked out the number of different kind of meows he has.
Yeah.
I mean, he came down just a little minute ago when I'm working, and he looked at me and he gave me this meow, which says, "I need a pee."
That's right.
So I open the back door, he goes in, he comes in, then he does it, "I want to play now." And then he's a completely different meow, a different one for breakfast, a different one for his treaties at night time. They're just so completely different, and he's a real talker. I mean, he sits at the front door doing little chirpy talks before you turn up in the days when you could.
Yeah, exactly. But it's because I'm his favourite Uncle Andy.
You are his favourite Uncle Andy. He adores you.
Yeah.
But I just think they're such clever creatures. You know,
yes.
People don't realise that. And, you know, he's so clever now that he can even get the treaties out of the treaty bag himself.
That's right. You see, my issue about this app, Amanda, I don't think you or I, who've had cats for years, decades, in fact, need an app for us to know what our moggies are telling us. Because, like you, I know exactly if for some reason there's not food in the bowl, one of them will be pushing me in the legs and meowing at my face. And I think, and I say, are you hungry? And I go into the kitchen, the bowl is empty. So I knew that. So I don't need an app.
But Andrew, they also have. I think that if you don't understand what your cat is saying to you, then you're not really treating them properly.
That's right.
Because they end up with the most incredible vocabularies. I mean, Ted jumps up in the morning. He doesn't sleep on the bed by choice, but he jumps up in the morning, which is this really sweetest little meow, which is to say, "I'm going to have a little cuddle with you and listen to the Today program," and so he does that, and then. But he just has
You put Ted through the Today program? How could you do that, Ted? Why does he want to listen to Misha Hussain? Oh, no.
But I do. I think if you just spend a bit more time listening to them and listening for the different kind of meows. I mean, like, he has a crazy meow when he wants to play, which is enough to make you think that, you know, he's going to tear you to pieces, which he never, of course, does. But I think it's a fantastic idea. Wouldn't we just love to know what our cats were really, really, really saying and thinking?
I think that's right. But what I'm still not quite certain about, where do you put the, do you put this app into your phone so then you have to follow it around? Can you put it in a...
You just download the app onto your phone.
Right.
And then you basically follow your cat around with it. And every time it meows, then it will translate it into something.
But I'm afraid it would be better if you could put it in a collar around their neck.
No, they're going to develop, that's what he wants to develop.
Ah.
He wants to develop a bit like, you know that movie Up, where the dogs have these human translating voice boxes around their
neck.
That's
right, yeah. Oh, that's what he wants
Sanchez
to do.
Wants
right.
to develop in the future. But you try putting that on Minnie, she'd rip you to pieces.
Well, I've given up on collars with them with bells on to alert birds and foxes because they're off in 3 minutes. It's just it's a great idea. And is Ted forgiven you for following around with the phone, Amanda?
Well, he didn't like it very much, I've got to say. And I do, you know, we have such lovely conversations. And one of the things I've noticed, because I've been working from home now for a year, is that he just talks so much, Andrew.
Yeah.
I mean, that he even has a special, really annoying meow when he wants to be brushed. Now, how clever is that?
He's a clever boy.
He's very clever.
How old is Ted now, Amanda?
I reckon he's about eight, so he's kind of middle-aged.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't think it. I mean, he's just, he behaves like a skittish little kitten. And Andrew also, you know, when I'm sick, you know, I was sick a couple of years ago, really badly sick and in bed a lot. And he never left my side, you know.
They know.
And he follows me around the house the whole time. You know, he's just like a little, you know, they say that dogs are the only ones that show you loyalty and compassion. It's just not true.
Absolutely. Read all about it, Amanda's fine piece about Meow Talk. And it's from the computer geek and engineer and, of course, cat lover, Javier Sanchez. Well, that's all we've got time for today for the latest from the Daily Mail. Why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show, and I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.